Hey, podcast listeners. This is Ann Altas, your podcaster, your blogger. What's going on? It's Sunday. Sunday. Kind of a dark day here in Madison, Wisconsin, but what are you up to? What's going on? I am recording the podcast. I've done some blogging today, and the whole point of this is to just talk to you about what's been on the blog. I'm going to read you some posts. Is there a lot of noise coming in from outdoors? I'm in the closet, trying to be quiet in the closet, but people still make noise in the environment. It's amazing all the little noises there are that you don't even hear. Anyway, the blog starts out this morning. This post went up at 4:35 a.m. Oh, my Lord, I'm getting up so early. What is the problem? You know, it gets dark early here, but doesn't really bother me because I go to bed very early. But I get up long before the first light. And sunrise is at 7 now, so if you get up at, you know, before 4, that's a long time. It's more like the evening is in the morning because it gets dark early at night, but I just go to bed. Then I'm up in the darkness for many hours, but that's when I write the blog, and I have a lot of energy and actually enjoy very much writing the blog at that time. And it's just the way it is, that it's dark in those hours. I put up a post about the obituary of Jan Morris, the travel writer. Jan Morris, a distinctive guide who took readers around the world. That's the headline for the New York Times editorial that's written by Dwight Garner. And I took out this quote. Morris lived for many years with her gravestone standing in a corner of her library, the ne plus ultra of memento moris. She was an inveterate traveler, but also prized her house in the Welsh village of Llanastumdwy. She wrote often about its snuggly higgalig, hugalig, how do you say that word? Snug, it means snuggly. Hugalig qualities. Death for her may be something akin to merely being in, to borrow the words of the novelist Joshua Cohen, a bed with a lid. I'm attracted to decline to the melancholy spectacle of things that get old and die, Morris told Leo Lerman in a Paris Review interview. She also joked that when she departed, the headlines would read, "Sex Change Author Dies." Jan Morris was born James Humphrey Morris on October 2, 1926, in Somerset, England. From 1964, when she began taking hormone pills, to 1972, when she had the surgery, she transitioned from female to female from male, a process documented in Conundrum, 1974, her critically and commercially successful memoir. She wrote more than 40 books, the bylines nearly evenly divided between James and Jan. She wrote a fair amount of doddle later in her life. Not all of her stuff is worth the investment. If you can make it through her books on Lincoln and Canada, you are a heartier person than I am. So that's from the obituary by Dwight Garner in the New York Times, which distinguishes itself with a headline, Jan Morris, a distinctive guide who took readers around the world, that does not say the thing that Morris joked would be the one distinction in the headlines for her obituary. In place of the distinction transgender, the Times gives Morris the distinction distinctive. I was intrigued by Garner's phrase, the ne plus ultra of memento moris. One's own graveyard is indeed the ne plus ultra of memento moris. I mulled over whether ne plus ultra or and memento moris should be italicized as foreign language words and looked them up in the Oxford English Dictionary. Ne plus ultra, the furthest attainable point or peak of perfection, has been in use in English since the 1600s. A Restoration-era play has the line, "Now, madam, you have seen the ne plus ultra of art." Memento mori has the distinction of appearing first in a work of William Shakespeare. Bardolph. "Why, Sir John, my face does you no harm." Falstaff. No, I'll be sworn, I make as good use of it as many a man doth of a death's head or a memento mori. I never see thy face, but I think upon hellfire and Dives that lived in purple, for there he is in his robes, burning, burning. And that's from Henry the Fourth, Part One. Falstaff makes good use of Bardolph's face. It looks like the face of a man burning in hell, and thus serves as a memento mori, a sobering reminder of death. So you get my point here. Should the words, these clearly Latin words, memento mori and ne plus ultra, should they appear in italics in the English text in the New York Times because they're not English? And I think their long existence in English writing shows them to be English words. We were talking about this in real space, real life, as opposed to writing life. And it seemed like maybe it, in order to become an English word, the spelling should change or something about it should change. It should morph in some way into an English word. Obviously, many Latin words are in the background, in the lineage that leads to an English word. But where it's exactly the same, it never gets translated. It just keeps getting used in the original form of the foreign language. Can we say that it is now an English word? Memento. Well, look, memento. We say memento, so why not memento mori? We wouldn't put the word memento in italics as a foreign word. We accept that as an English word. So that shows, that's just one example that pops out, obviously, of how a word can become an English word without changing in any way. But memento mori and ne plus ultra really do look foreign. Nevertheless, I accept them as unitalicized words, as words that have become English. They've been around since circa 1600. And they look a little odd smashed together, the ne plus ultra of memento moris. But I think that the writer Dwight Garner intended that stylistically, to put two Latin phrases side by side, and thought it looked cool. So I accept that, and I accept it not being italicized. So see, this is what I'm thinking about, talking about at 4 in the morning, is whether certain familiar Latin phrases are legitimate English words, and whether we care about the italicization of words in an English text that are not English words. There are several solutions here. You could just say, I don't care about italicizing words just because they're foreign words. That doesn't even need to be done. And then another way of putting it is to say, well, these words have become English words by their longstanding existence in English text. And also, I hope you enjoyed my reading of Shakespeare. I thought that was a very interesting thing. Falstaff saying to Bardolph, I make as good a use of your face. I use your face the way many men use a death's head. So in other words, some people might, not so much these days, but in the old days, it was seen as an important to one's character or moral development or philosophical depth that you always thought of death, that whatever you did, you also remembered that you will die. And one thing that people did would be to actually have a skull. Put that over in the corner of your desk instead of a vase full of flowers. How about a skull, just so you don't forget that you're going to die someday? And so I make as good of use of your face, Bardolph, as many a man doth of a skull that he puts over in the corner of his desk as a memento mori. Every time I see your face, I think of hellfire, and I think of that rich man, Dives, that lived in purple. There he is, in his robes, burning. You look like you're burning in hell. I guess he had a florid face. I had to look up Dives. That kind of confused me, D-I-V-E-S. But Dives is just another name for the rich man in the story of Lazarus in the Bible. This is from Wikipedia. I link to this. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus, also called the Dives, or is it Dives? I don't know. And Lazarus is a well-known parable of Jesus appearing in the Gospel of Luke. In the parable, Jesus tells his audience, his disciples and some Pharisees, of the relationship during life and after death between an unnamed rich man and a poor beggar named Lazarus. The traditional name Dives is not actually a name, but instead is a word for rich man. I'm not sure how to say it, in the text of the Latin Bible, the Vulgate. The rich man was also given the name Nuez, or Nineveh, and Phineas in the 3rd and 4th centuries. Anonymity and naming play an important role in the parable. Ordinarily, poverty is anonymous, and wealth is acknowledged. Yet Lazarus is named, and the rich man is anonymous, anticipating the reversal that occurs in the end. Well, what happens in the parable of Lazarus and the rich man? There was a rich man. This is from the New International Version of the Bible, Luke 16:19-31. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I'm in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been set in place, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have 5 brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to them, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." So then later I added this quote from Morris. I kept thinking about that obituary, and I wanted to add another quote. This is something that Morris said a while back. "What I can't stand is being patronized by men, treated as a second-class citizen. Just because I'm a woman, there are people now who think that I haven't got a mind anymore. Sometimes even those who've known me before." And I said, presumably, "before" refers to the various treatments she received, including hormone therapy. Did the hormones change how she wrote? I mean, were they just looking at her and saying, "because I see you as a woman now, I think you've lost something. I don't think you have a mind. I respected your mind when I looked at you and saw a man. But now that I'm looking at you and seeing a woman, I subjectively think of you as less valuable, less able to think." So it could be the observer's prejudice. But isn't it also possible that the hormones really do change the person, and that she really did change in some way? I mean, she wanted to change. She felt, presumably, like her idea of what it was to be a woman, took the hormones, which are feminizing, whatever that means, got those hormones into her, and then was different in some ways. But what ways? What did outside observers think? Were they looking at the person and seeing she looks feminine now, and then infusing their prejudice into their perceptions and saying, "seems like you don't have a mind anymore"? Or did the hormones perhaps actually change the way she thought? Now, there would still be the question of what was the change, and what were the perceptions that the change read to the observer as, you don't have a mind anymore. There are levels and levels of prejudice and actual evidence, and there's no way for us now to go back to that and ask what that was other than to just wonder. I said, did the hormones change how she wrote? You know, it used to be very much more commonly said, oh, women can't write like men, or maybe an occasional woman would be said to write like a man. What does that mean? Some people think men write in a loftier or better or more, I don't know, rational way than women, that there are differences. And if there aren't differences, why would anyone feel like changing their presentation of what sex they are? Why would that have any meaning to them? It has to have some meaning to want to make the leap, to go to all of this effort, to take these treatments. Why would you take the treatments? What is it for? It has to mean something to you, so what does it mean? Anyway, that's all an elaborate conundrum. And I'm just wondering, when she got so angry, what I can't stand is being patronized by men, treated as a second-class citizen, just because I'm a woman. Right? What was really going on there? Was she different in some way that they were perceiving and reacting to? Or were they just rank bigots who think women are lesser beings? Now, the author of the obituary, Dwight Garner, said, as I read to you earlier, she wrote a fair amount of doddle later in her life. Well, later in her life was when she had had the hormone treatments. Was she writing a fair amount of doddle because she had been affected by these hormones, and the hormones really did change the quality of her mind? Now, that would be such a politically incorrect thing to say that I just can't believe Dwight Garner would write that and that it would be published in the Times. To come right out and say, after she had the sex reassignment treatments, after she got the hormones, she wrote a fair amount of doddle. I don't think that would even be permitted. I think the only reason that's in there is because the decline seemed to have to do with age and not with the hormone therapy. And in fact, I feel like it's politically incorrect even to write this out on my part, to even to ask the question whether it's possible that the female hormones had a negative effect on writing. I mean, I'm not even saying that they do. I have no idea. I'm just positing it as something that would be interesting to know and to observe this one piece of evidence, which is that Dwight Garner, the book critic of the New York Times, the nonfiction book critic of the New York Times, said that Jan Morris wrote a fair amount of doddle later in her life. Doddle, speaking of language, doddle is another unusual word. It's kind of British. I had to look it up. To doddle is kind of like to toddle in walking, little steps, insecure, infirm steps. So you might picture the way an old person. So I think doddle kind of nudges you to think this is an age problem. So to doddle, the verb, is to walk in this unsteady, small-stepped way. And then doddle, the noun, she wrote a fair amount of doddle later in her life. That's writing doddle as a noun. It means to, like easy steps, doddle, easy work. You know, it's like little steps, infirm steps. So think of the word, the verb, and then the noun based on that verb. Well, that's all I have to say about Jan Morris. I have never read any Jan Morris books. I don't read a lot of travel memoirs. I guess I wasn't interested enough in the personal story of this sex transition. Gender transition. The second post of the day is about some new bodies that were unearthed at Pompeii. I was a little surprised that they haven't found them all yet. After all these years, they still encountered some, you know, full-sized figures of two men in interesting positions had been discovered recently at Pompeii. Bodies of man and his slave unearthed from ashes at Pompeii. Some people in the comments over there were critical of that language, bodies of a man and his slave. Well, they're both men. It's the bodies of two men. This is like the Lazarus and the rich man problem. Why is one called the man and the other person is called his slave? Why isn't it a body of man and his master? What? Why is the one the possession of the other. Well, obviously slavery works that way, but you know, that one is in the is the possession of the other, but is the headline dehumanizing toward the slave. Well, that's pretty picky, but if you say slave, you trigger some strong reactions, and it and that headline did get that comment. Bodies of man and his slave unearthed from ashes in Pompeii. Two men died together. Why not treat them with equal dignity? Well, first you have to detect unequal dignity, but I'm just saying that there were people that were detecting that indignity. I pulled out this quote for the headline of the Post. The victims were probably looking for shelter in the crypto porticus, in this underground space where they thought they were better protected. And I had to look up crypto porticus to try to understand what that was. I have a link to Wikipedia and I where you can see some photographs of it. It's just an underground hallway in an old Roman type of architecture. And here's a quote from the article that tells you how they figured out what they did about these two people. How did they, how when you just see two figures who died next to each other, you know why they died? They died in the ashes. How do you figure out that one was the slave of the other? What would be left there that would say this was the slave? Quote, judging by cranial bones and teeth, one of the men was young, likely aged 18 to 25, with a spinal column with compressed discs. That finding led archaeologists to hypothesize that he was a young man who did manual labor, like that of a slave. The other man had a robust bone structure, especially in his chest area, and died with his hands on his chest and his legs bent and spread apart. He was estimated to have been 30 to 40 years old. Fragments of white paint were found near the man's face, probably remnants of collapsed upper wall, the official said. Both skeletons were found in a side room along an underground corridor or passageway known in ancient Roman times as a crypto porticus, which led to the upper level of the villa. So maybe they got down, the ashes were coming in on them, and they got down into this low area thinking that they might find protection there. And they obviously died. Now, the next post, which went up at 6:35 a.m., what is that noise? Scary animals outside? No, I don't think so. This is a quote. I quoted myself. I wanted to do this. I wanted to go back to what I said about the election when I went to sleep on election night. So the last thing I wrote before I quit for the night on election night was, I'd like a crisply clear result to come into focus as soon as possible, and I'd like gracious winners and losers all united in love for our beautiful country. And I said, this morning I said, I was thinking about that this morning after remembering a phrase I'd used in yesterday's podcast. I showed some empathy for Trump, who's been so focused for so long on winning, winning, winning. And I thought of the idea that he can still win, if only to win at losing. So how do you be the gracious loser? How do you lose well? How to lose well? It's hard to win well, too, because you can gloat. Be a good winner. That shouldn't be so hard. But how do you be a good loser? You know, you're a bad winner if you taunt the other person as a loser, which I think some people are doing. Some people on the Biden side are doing. But if you are the loser, how can you be a great loser? How can you be the best loser possible? Best loser ever. Be a fantastic loser. I had to add an update because at 6:13 a.m., I see, this was, I noticed this after I wrote what I wrote, but I went over to Twitter to see what was going on, and I saw that Donald Trump had responded to someone who said, I'm not tired of winning yet. And Donald Trump said, and neither am I. So he still has an appetite for winning. He still wants to win. He's still trying to win. You know, he has a lot of spirit, but I think he's going to have to let go of it soon. Otherwise, he's going to look miserable with his fighting without the proper grounds to fight, and it will just look pathetic. At some point, you're Baghdad Bob. What's more absurd? The next post, which was kind of the post, I spent so long writing this post, and I got down some interesting cryptoporticuses. This post, I was playing the New York Times game Spelling Bee. So I like this game. I do the New York Times crossword, but I also like to play Spelling Bee. I played today. I got to the genius level, but you have 7 letters with 1 letter in the middle, and you try to make words. They have to be at least 4 letters long, and all the words have to have the middle letter. So today the middle letter was Y, and then the letters around the outside. Well, I could tell you what the pangram is, but maybe it will be a spoiler for you. Plug your ears. No, I won't even say it. Oh, well, maybe I should say it. The pangram, the word that uses all the letters, is cacophony. So if you got cacophony, you got the pangram. And then you had to get enough other words. I eventually got enough other words. I got yoo-hoo, I got canopy, I got happy, but I tried nappy. And to me, nappy is a word that refers to a diaper. And it can also mean, it can also be an adjective that refers to certain kinds of fabrics, like a sort of fake suede would have a nap to it. Like if you're sewing, the nap, you have to lay out the fabric, the pattern pieces on the fabric directionally, because they have to all, if you rub it one way, it looks one way. You rub it the other way, it looks the other way. So you can't just mix that up. You have to keep them all going the same way. I used to make jumpers and things like that when I was in high school out of fabric. And I used some fabric that had a nap to it. Nap isn't an ugly word. The idea of fabric has a nap. Anyway, the help page at the... So the post's title is Nappy a Racial Slur? And the help page at Spelling Bee only says, our word list does not include words that are obscure, hyphenated, or proper nouns. No cussing either. Sorry. So nappy. So I tried to put in nappy, and it said, I took a screenshot of it, not in word list. So why wasn't it in the word list? It's not obscure, not hyphenated, not a proper noun. So is it cussing? Cussing, in other words, offensive words. Nappy must be a cuss. I've noticed in the past that coon is off the word list, even though the word coon can mean raccoon. Or, though there's not much occasion to say this anymore, a member of the Whig Party, the American Whig Party, because they had a raccoon symbol, you know, just like today the Democrats have a donkey and the Republicans have an elephant. In those days, the Whigs had a raccoon, which is a nice American animal that might be a good idea for your party, although they do look kind of like bandits with their eye mask. Coon. It can be a racial slur, but the same word is also used not to be a racial slur. And nappy, similarly, can also mean diaper. And it can describe the surface of some velvety fabrics. It seems that Spelling Bee eliminates a word when one meaning is an insult, a particular sort of insult aimed at members of a group that has historically experienced subordination. But is nappy an insult? It almost seems insulting to think of nappy as an insult, right? Why is it a bad thing? If it's descriptive of the kind of hair that a person has, to say that that's insulting is to have the opinion that the hair is bad. Where does the opinion that the hair is bad come from? How does the word convey that? I mean, is the word curly an insult? Is the word straight an insult? Is the word black an insult? You know, you have to take the characteristic and think of it as bad for the descriptive word to become an insult, unless it's just people have decided it's an insult. People are triggered by the word. They've told you it's an insult. So that's their opinion. And out of respect, you should simply adopt that opinion and not use it. Although when you're trying to play spelling bee and you're writing nappy and you're thinking diaper or this an adjective describing fabric, you don't feel that you've said a bad word. It's not like the N word. I mean, I feel free to say nappy out loud. I don't think it's a bad word. And I said coon out loud in the context of thinking of a raccoon. I mean, when Davy Crockett had a coonskin cap, do people think some kind of lurid Ed Gein type of hat-making process involving human skin? No, no. It's a raccoon. Anyway, I found, so I got looking into this, trying to think of why nappy would be considered such an insult that it would get eliminated from the spelling bee word list. I found this article from last year at NPR, The Racial Roots Behind the Term Nappy. And shifting to the middle of the article, I want to tell you about a little anecdote. I'll read you the quote, but it's an anecdote about something that happened in 1998. So that was before I was blogging. This would be an extremely interesting subject to blog, so I'm happy to put it on the blog now. Really interesting controversy. Quote, in 1998, white New York City school teacher Ruth Sherman received tremendous backlash after assigning Nappy Hair, a book by Carolivia Herron, focused on cultivating positive feelings about nappy hair in young children. One of the parents was not pleased, according to an investigation launched by the New York City's Department of Education, because of the belief that the phrase nappy hair was a racial slur. The debate resulted in a firestorm of calls to have Sherman fired. And Noel Louis Rooks, author of Hair Raising, Beauty, Culture, and the African-American Woman, said Sherman had what she considered to be viable death threats against her, all because she was trying to teach little kids, many of which were of African descent, that nappy could be seen as positive. Rooks said that when she first heard about the controversy, she was sure it was centered on the misconception that Sherman, a white woman, was being racially insensitive. But Rooks says the parents weren't accusing Sherman of discrimination. Rather, they confronted her for framing nappy hair as a positive. You start to hear that the parents were like, why would you be trying to tell my child that her nappy hair is a good thing? I found that fascinating. Nearly a decade later, in 2007, and I remember blogging this, nappy was once again thrown into the national spotlight after radio host Don Imus used the term nappy-headed hoes in reference to the Rutgers women's basketball team. The backlash was immediate. Dot, dot, dot. I won't explain all of that, but you can go look at the article if you don't remember it. And the writer of the NPR article says that she asked Zine Magubane, associate sociology professor at Boston College, whether there was a context where the term nappy could be used in a non-offensive manner. Her response was blunt, no. And she said, certain social movements have changed the meaning of what any word is supposed to describe. So slut, for example, we have enough of a female revolution so that the idea that a woman must be chaste is mostly gone. But she says neither the culture nor the context has undergone a change significant enough for nappy to get the same treatment. And I said, what would it take? Magabane seems to say that racism must end before the word can be reclaimed as positive. So this idea that that black people themselves could flip the word into a positive meaning while there was still racism, while there were some people supposedly still being hateful about that kind of hair that black people have. As long as that's true, the proper approach is to ban the word and regard the word as always an insult instead of saying it's not insulting, it's good. That there are lots of different kinds of hair. We have diversity of hair, and they're all good. And children should be made to feel fine about whatever it is they have. Here's this idea, no, don't do that. Keep it negative. The word does have a history. Maybe another word could be used. Curly hair, Lots of people love curly hair. All sorts of people have curly hair. Say curly hair. But nappy has a particular meaning. Why can't it be reclaimed as something positive, the way slut and queer, and I'm sure there are numerous other words, have been reclaimed. But Mukabane, the sociology professor, says, no, cannot do it. Absolutely not. The article goes on to say that the author called up Tricia R. Thomas, author of the book Napoli Ever After, which inspired the Netflix hit of the same name. Thomas said, I wrote Napoli with the goal of putting the term in a new light. I knew it may be causing a little stir, but I knew I had to resist the fear and do what I thought was right. Thomas was asked whether there's hope that the word can become positive, and she said, if you'd asked me this when I wrote the book in 2000, I would have told you, yes, there is hope. But I just don't think so anymore. There's a group damaged by the word's hurtful connotation whose pain will never go away. I saw the depths of their hurt, and it was painful to even witness. At this point, I've accepted that it's always going to be a triggering word. Always. And I said, well, that's sad, and it explains the simple censorship today at the New York Times Spelling Bee. Then I said, you can stop now, but keep going for some musical digression and an investigation of the obscure slang word mamlish. Okay, so now we go into the crypto porticus of the post, the lower depths, the extra stuff. And once again, I'm checking out the Oxford English Dictionary. I looked up nappy in the Oxford English Dictionary, and the second definition was U.S. slang, frequently derogatory, of hair, especially that of a black person, frizzy. One of the quotes there was from a 1927 song by Bobby Grant called Nappy Head Blues. Hey, that was the first time I tried the effect of adding a song, so I wonder how that worked. Was that too much music for you? Did you hear the lyrics? Your head is so nappy, feet so mamlish long. You look like a turkey coming through the mamlish corn. Now, you got to be wondering, what is mamlish? So listen to this song, Mamlish Blues, and see if you can tell. Well, I hope this is working out with the music. This is the first time I've done this, a very different podcast. I'll give you a link to the lyrics to the song, and just let me sum up the places where the word mamlish appeared. These are all quotes from the lyrics. You used to be my sugar, but you ain't sweet, no mamlish more. Mama, must I sell it or keep it for my mamlish self? Well, my mama, she didn't like me. My papa, he gave me mamlish way. Talking about your stroller, but you just ought to see mamlish mine. She was standing on a corner between 25th and mamlish Maine. Okay, so how do you figure that out? It seems to be an intensifier word. It seems to work like damned or fucking, as those words are used by people who say them as often as possible. Like, she was standing on a corner between 25th and fucking Maine. Well, my mama, she didn't like me, but my papa, he gave me fucking away. Or, blah, blah, blah. That's the intensifier use of a word. It doesn't really do anything except be there. It's not even as meaningful as very. It sort of has no meaning, but it has all meaning. And I've researched this word, and it's not in people don't know the origin of it. It seemed to have its little period in the 20s, in a few songs, maybe there are 10 songs with that word in it. And there was a record label called Mamlish Records, so there was that as well. But obviously these uses in the song are not referring to a record label there. It's a much more general word. There's also the song Bullfrog Blues by William Harris. There, did you pick up the spot where he said mamlish? That's a song, you know, that song was done by Canned Heat. There's a David Bromberg version that I remember hearing and thinking Bromberg made it up. I mean, it begins with, have you ever woke up with them blue bullfrogs on your mind? And I thought that was just a sort of a hippie-ish joke from the early 70s, but no, that goes back to the 20s as well. Mamlish comes up in Harris's song in the middle of a word. I got the bullfrog blues, mama. Can't be satis, mamlish-fied. So I think it's like saying, I can't be satis-fucking-fied, like that. Anyway, did you notice the racism that came up in that song? There was one of the verses in that song is just astonishingly racist. So it's a black man singing this. And I'm going to tell you the lyrics. I'm telling you the lyrics for their historical value and just to see how well, obviously it's humorous. But, you know, there was ethnic humor in those days of a sort that people just do not do anymore. But this is one verse of that song, Bullfrog Blues. I'm going to tell you, buddy, what a Chinaman told. A Chinaman told, I mean a Jew. I'm going to tell you what a Chinaman told a Jew. You don't like me? Well, I sure, God, don't like you. That's pretty harsh. But so that's the extra material. All started by the effort to play Spelling Bee and its rejection of my attempt to use the word nappy. Next, at 10:36 a.m., we see a quote from Vladimir Putin, who was asked if his declining to congratulate Joe Biden might damage U.S.-Russian relations. And he said, there's nothing to damage. They're already ruined. So I thought what Putin said about the election was pretty darn lucid and very close to what I kind of think about congratulating Joe on winning. And this is Putin. Quote, we will work with anyone who has the confidence of the American people, but that confidence can only be given to a candidate whose victory has been recognized by the opposing party or after the results are confirmed in a legitimate, legal way. So that's a kind of a cool, distanced approach that I would accept, too, other than that I don't need to work with anyone. He's just going to wait and see who the president is, and whoever it is, he has to go with that. And that's really all I've got there on the blog, except for a photograph of the dawn this morning. I went out for my sunrise run, and it was a super soft morning. There was a softness to the sky. It was almost completely blue, but there was some sort of slight mist near the water and clouds near the horizon, and it made for a most beautiful, soft mistiness. So I'm hoping for things to come into crisp clarity, but sometimes you look at the world and there is a softness to it. There is a vagueness to it, a fuzziness. If I could use the word nappy, I might say that that's a quality that the world could have, like a fabric that can be brushed and look a different way, and you could even write your name in it in the nap. So there was a softness to the land this morning as I went out at dawn. And maybe there is sometimes is a softness to the world, and maybe we can find the world beautiful even when things are unclear, even when things are ambiguous, or there are strange words that we don't really understand, like ne plus ultra, memento mori, and mamlish.